Well, the question becomes, who do we worship? Do we worship God? Or do we worship and then kind of fill in the blank? See, it's a question I think we need to ask ourselves and to be willing to honestly answer. And it's basically what Elijah is asking the people of Israel. Yet if you notice, they're kind of silent at first, aren't they? They're not willing to answer. They're kind of hedging their bets, waiting to see, well, I'll follow the one that ends up on top. And yet by hedging their bets and sort of worshiping God and sort of worshiping Baal, in fact, what they are doing is fully worshiping Baal. They're asked, how long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow Him. If Baal, then follow Him. I need to give you a little bit of background on this interesting section, one of kind of my favorite ones in 1 Kings. Now, for many of you know that Elijah is a prophet of God whose job it is to remind people of who God is and what He expects of His people. See, the king of Israel was supposed to be God's representative on earth. He was supposed to be ruling in a way that represented God and looked out for God's interests. But unfortunately, the person we have on the throne in this time is Ahab. And Ahab comes from a family that did the opposite of what God wanted. Continued to thumb their noses at Him, and they relished in their own power and authority that the kingship gave them. In fact, even as evil as we hear that Ahab's father was, we're told that Ahab was even worse. Earlier in 1 Kings, we're told, Ahab, son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. And as if that had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, he took as his wife Jezebel, daughter of King Ethbaal of the Sidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him. Ahab did more to provoke the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, than had all the kings of Israel who were before him. Not really a great kind of biography that you'd want to publish, is it? One person described Ahab this way. Ahab saw himself as a king who happened to be a Jew, while God expected him to be a Jew who happened to be king. I think that's something we all need to take into account. We need to take that to heart. Where does our lives as Christians stand in our estimation of ourselves? How do we define ourselves? Because it's how we define ourselves goes a long way in answering that first question of who we're worshiping. Are we Americans who happen to be Christians? Or are we Christians who happen to be Americans? Are we, and then we can kind of fill in whatever descriptor you want, are we mothers, fathers, kind of accountants, soldiers, CEOs, whatever it is, who happen to be a Christian? Or are we followers of Jesus Christ first and foremost in our lives? See, we live in a pluralistic world just like Ahab and Elijah did. And who doesn't read or see something or hear something about being tolerant in the news and in the paper? And as it is important to be able to tolerate those who believe differently than we do, it does not mean that we participate in that belief and abandon our own. See, I think the true meaning of tolerance has been lost if we defined it. Because true tolerance means to amicably disagree, yet be willing to continue to dialogue while still holding on to your own beliefs, knowing what is true. Sadly, though, today it often means that we have to give up our beliefs if it offends somebody else, or if it's counter to their beliefs, then ours don't matter. And I truly believe that atheism has become the state religion of our culture. And there's an old Calvin and Hobbes cartoon that I have to share because I love Calvin and Hobbes. And for those that might not remember him, you know, Calvin, and he had his stuffed tiger Hobbes, who in Calvin's mind was a real tiger. And he's sitting there doing his homework, which he probably doesn't want to do. And he's asking and saying to Hobbes, and he says, You know, I don't think math is a science. I think it's a religion. To which Hob, a religion? And Calvin goes, yeah, all these equations are like miracles. You take two numbers and you add them together, and then magically they become a new number. No one can say how it happens. You either believe it or you don't. This whole book is full of things that have to be accepted on faith. It's a religion. And Hobbes just says, oh, and in the public schools, no less. Call a lawyer. Which Calvin just responds, as a math atheist, I should be excused from this. Well, Erwin Lutzer has a book out that's called 10 Lies About God, in which he examines how we've allowed the culture to dictate who God is, rather than allowing God himself to do that. Some of the lies he looks at are, God is whatever we want him to be. Or many paths lead into God's presence. Or God is more tolerant now than he used to be. And so forth. But at one point, he writes, what we believe about God is the most important thing about us. Yet subtle influences in today's culture, such as postmodernism, New Age thought, and liberal theologians, declare that God's authority is limited, that his love is minimal. To make sure our convictions, views, and assumptions about our Creator stay based on biblical truths and not popular consensus, we must continually check what we believe against scriptures. It seems logical enough, and yet we often don't do that. And so now we come back to the situation on Mount Carmel. I mean, there's a reason God gave us the Ten Commandments. He knew what would be the things that would give us the most temptations. And so what did he do? He cautioned us, don't do it. It's pretty simple. And he didn't just do it to be a cosmic wet blanket on things that we wanted to do, but because he, being our Creator, knew actually what's best for us. So why I make the confirmands memorize the Ten Commandments, so I'm not going to put Ethan on the spot right now. And the first two, I want to remind us all, since you're all sitting there going, well, I don't memorize them. The first two are pretty straightforward and basic. And yet ones that we break over and over again, just like the Israelites. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. It's pretty straightforward. But how often do we forget that God's a jealous God? The people in Elijah's day did the same thing. And even though it can seem that God is distant and sometimes not active in the world, what are we shown today but that he can do whatever he wants when he wants it? Because we need to remember, like Baal of so many thousands of years ago, the gods the world puts forward today are impotent to do anything that we don't allow them to do. But I think what I love most about this portion of 1 Kings is Elijah's taunting of the prophets of Baal. And I just wanted to share an interesting note. The meaning when Elijah actually questions if Baal has wandered away, you know, maybe he's sleeping, maybe he's gone on a trip. Well, when he's wandered away, he's really saying, well, perhaps he's in the bathroom and can't be disturbed. Basically saying, is this really what you're putting your trust and your hope and your lives? And look at the situation. I mean, the odds are not in Elijah's favor. He's one man against 450 prophets, the entire ruler's authority of the nation, and then pretty much all the people who are only going to side with him if God actually shows up and does something big. So we need to remember that just because the majority believes something, just because the majority votes for something, just because the majority is living or acting in a certain way, does not necessarily make that thing, whatever it is, the truth or right for a believer to do. As one commentator points out, Augustine knew that our hearts are restless until they find their rest in God. Inevitably, idolatry lures believers. Our tendency to cling to sources of obscurity that are not God leaves us looking, in turn, ridiculous and pathetic. The biting irony of the Elijah story requires candor about this. We frantically dance to appease the powers that are not real. We try to ensure prosperity through things that cannot respond to us. We look for hope in things that cannot truly transform our lives. When we fail to recognize God as a source of our rest and our peace, we live our lives chaotically on the edge of depression. Seeking the holy in profane places, we go limping through life with two different opinions. Our idols may appear in various garbs, depending on the values and mores of our context. A believer living in a gated suburban subdivision may be seduced by the materialistic culture that fosters addiction to high-end possessions. Or a believer living in a turbulent inner-city neighborhood may be tempted to seek security in a kind of gang solidarity that uses violence to reinforce group norms. But however we clothe our idols, they cannot save us. We hear this in the story of Elijah, victory, a thunderous exhortation to seek peace and flourishing only in the one true God. Each of us have our own idols. What is it that we're worshiping that cannot save? We were baptizing this morning a beautiful young little girl. And in the process, we reaffirm what we believe. I pray we take to heart what we're professing. I mean, these are not just words. These are vows and commitments to the God of Israel, to the God that sacrificed himself so that we might truly live. So the question stands for us as well. If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. Amen.